This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll talk today with some reporters in Northwest Indiana media about the stories that they happen to have had online, in print, and on the air. We also have some things online as well. We will have Meredith Colius Pete from the Post Tribune with us to talk about the stories that she has. Also, too, Dan Carden, the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, joins us today. Doug Gross from the Times of Northwest Indiana will talk about his Porter County stories of recent day. And we'll also, as well, have Sharon Jackson and Tommy Williams here from Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And let's start in first with Dan Carden, who covers State House and other state government news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. As always, Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's take in the question first, I guess, of some of the use of some of our tax money that has gone to Indianapolis and is, I guess, finally coming back to many local governments here because of some kind of processing issues. This is something that came about that you highlighted from the Department of Revenue this week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Department of Revenue is undergoing this massive technology upgrade. The systems they've been using are decades old. They were customized for the state a long time ago, and it's really impeded the efficiency of the Department of Revenue in completing all of its work. So last year when they approved the budget, the General Assembly authorized spending money up to $100 million over the next 7 years to upgrade the technology of the Department of Revenue. One of the things the department found as it's in the process of upgrading its technology was that some income tax money that Hoosiers paid that was supposed to go to local governments kind of just got lost in the system. There was a scanning problem in one instance where people whose counties weren't correctly noted on their tax forms, the money didn't get directed to their counties. And then there was a second problem where people who pay taxes but don't file an income tax return, that money was just getting kind of thrown into a general pot rather than allocated for the county where they live. So the Department of Revenue has, they say, corrected these problems, and they credited this technological upgrade for helping them find these issues with the tax collections and the distributions. And now, according to the department, the money is going to go back out to the local governments that were supposed to get it in the first place.
That sounds like it. This money that you, if you're a small business person, that you don't keep have to keep track of on a form, but you do it on a quarterly basis, I guess, don't you? And that must be the money that went into the big pot, apparently, and didn't get allocated.
Actually, it was more sort of people who don't pay their taxes on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a business, but if you don't file an income tax return, but you need, say, to register your car, you might go to the Department of Revenue and say, I'm blocked from registering my car because I haven't paid any taxes. What can I pay to let that go through? So they just throw some money at
it. I see. It's some way that does cover the cost, but just they say it's not a usual way that you would normally take care of it, I guess. Yeah, if you don't do a tax return.
Right.
I also noticed in the story that you had in the Times that you did a little breakout on how the Northwest Indiana counties are going to get allocated their funds here. Tell us about how Lake and in particular Lake and Porter counties and LaPorte counties are going to get their money.
Yeah, Lake County actually is going to get the most out of the three. It's $1.8 million, but the way Lake County spends its income tax money, that money has to go toward property tax relief.
Right.
So it's not a whole lot of new money. The county will get about $100,000 for public safety, another $100,000 for economic development. Then the cities and towns in Lake County will split almost $400,000. But, you know, when you divide that 19 ways based on population, you know, some of these smaller towns are going to get a few hundred bucks, which isn't going to do much for them, but, you know, it's their money, so they should have gotten it in the first place.
Okay. How about
Porter County is looking at about $300,000. That's mostly for economic development purposes. And then LaPorte County will be getting about the same.
Well, I wonder if you get the impression that once they get this IT system upgrade done in the years ahead, that the state and in particular the Department of Revenue is going to be a little more efficient in how these tax dollars, when they come in, how they're accounted for.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal of Revenue Commissioner Adam Krupp and certainly the goal of Governor Holcomb. If you remember, a few years ago in 2012, there were quite a few problems at the Department of Revenue where they ended up losing track of, I think it was $320 million corporate income tax payments.
Right.
And then there was a similar shorting of local governments by about $200 million. That got fixed at the time, but that was the point at which state legislators and and the three governors we've had since then realized that something needed to be done to bring the Department of Revenue into the 21st century.
I suppose it's kind of the same way of upgrading your home computer. If you're on Windows 98, you need to have the latest version, I suppose.
Yeah, at times. I mean, you can get Indiana is a fiscally conservative state, so they tend to buy things once and make them last.
Yeah.
But at some point, it's costing you more. And the inefficiency is costing you more than it would cost to replace it. And presumably in the future, by being more efficient, you can spend less on employees and get your money faster and more accurately.
One of the other stories that you had in print online here just in recent days, of course, was the Indiana Republican Party. They just held their convention last week in Evansville, and you had a chance to check that out. Tell us what you got out of the convention down there, and also, too, if you have a little preview as well, too, of the Indiana Democratic Party convention, which is coming up this weekend.
Yeah, the main task for the convention was to nominate the candidates for Secretary of State, State Auditor, and State Treasurer. Republicans currently hold all three of those offices, so they renominated Connie Lawson for Secretary of State, Kelly Mitchell for State Treasurer, Tara Klutz for State Auditor. But the main focus of the convention ended up being this debate over marriage. For the third consecutive convention, Governor Holcomb and the new party chairman, Kyle Hupfer, had proposed some revised language on the marriage issue, the marriage question, and that would have recognized that not all Hoosier families consist of a mother and a father who are married to each other with, you know, their little children, that there are parents, single parents out there who are raising kids, there are grandparents raising kids, there are relatives raising kids, there's foster parents, there's all sorts of different families in Indiana. The revised platform would have recognized that, mm-hmm. but it got a lot of pushback from the delegates, particularly a group of marriage equality opponents that didn't want the word marriage, and specifically marriage between a man and a woman, removed from the platform. That was put in the platform in 2014 during Governor Pence's administration, right at the height of the whole gay marriage debate before the Supreme Court legalized it nationwide. And they wanted to see that language remain in the platform. The week leading up to the convention, they steadily increased the pressure on the party leaders. Eventually, the party leaders gave in and agreed to have a floor vote. There was a provision for people to raise their hands, but the voice vote was so overwhelming at the convention in favor of retaining the man-woman marriage language that that stayed in the platform from 2016 or carried over, and the revised language that was supposed to be more inclusive got cut out. So according to the Indiana Republican Party, strong families continue to be based on marriage between a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if eventually, since we know that Porter County Republican Party Chairman Mike Simpson was one of these that had advocated for the revision, I wonder if maybe, if not this time around, if in the future that this will finally get adapted so that we have all these other possibilities of families to be included besides just the man and the woman.
Yeah, it's one of those issues that some people still feel extremely strongly about it, even though if you look at polls, you know, a majority of Hoosiers, 60-70%, are okay with gay marriage and believe that the state law should protect LGBT civil rights, which is something that isn't currently in law because the Republican-controlled General Assembly has rejected proposals along those lines mm-hmm. Several times in the past few years. So, you know, it's one of those things, attitudes take time to change. Some in the Republican Party thought now was the time to change it, and they learned from their delegates that it's not quite there yet.
Now, taking a look here to this coming weekend, as we mentioned earlier, the Indiana Democratic Party will have their statewide convention here to set their I guess platform, and as well as their candidates for the ballot for November. What's it look like to you from what is ahead?
Yeah, we're going to have two candidates at the Democratic convention from Northwest Indiana who are going to be nominated. Jim Harper from Valparaiso is going to be the Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. And John Aguilera from East Chicago is going to be the Democratic candidate for state treasurer. There's a former city councilwoman from Marion who is going to be the state auditor candidate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Northwest Indiana is going to be, in effect, leading the ticket for the Democrats going into this race. And if you count Joe Donnelly, who's from Granger near South Bend, I mean, kind of, you know, it's kind of our region of the state is really going to determine whether the Democrats succeed in the fall or whether the Republicans continue to maintain their hold on all these offices.
That's good. Good to hear news. We know that since Scott Pilat decided to step down from his seat in the legislature, and he, of course, has been a longtime a bulwark of the Indiana Democratic Party and other people, too, from Northwest Indiana. It's nice to see that that the region still gets listed here and gets tallied up here as being very strong for the party overall in the state.
Yeah, well, that's actually good and bad for the Democratic Party in Indiana, that the party is really concentrated at this point in Northwest Indiana, in Marion County, and then some college towns, and it doesn't have much of a pulse throughout the rest of the state. You know, there's been talk within the Democratic Party of how do they reach out to other Hoosiers. You know, Southern Indiana used to be a big stronghold for Democrats. Western Indiana, you think of, you know, John Gregg from Sanborn. You know, there's no Democrats from that area anymore in the General Assembly. So we'll see what happens with the party. They claim they're energized and ready for this convention, ready to reach out to Hoosier voters. They think there's enough that are disaffected by what's happening at the national level with President Trump, Vice President Pence, that they think they can pick up some seats. So it'll be up to the voters.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of minutes or so left here. Dan, let's take up the story that you had on here and the action from federal court on a judge's decision involving the 2017 law about county election officials, registration of voters, and the like.
Yeah. So this is it's kind of technical, but Indiana has a process where it sends its voter records to the Secretary of State of Kansas, who collects them from all over the country and compares them to see if there are any duplicates registered in different states. Then he sends the duplicates back to all the states, or the suspected duplicates back to all the states. Prior to 2017, the Indiana had a process where the potential duplicates would be sent to the counties. The counties were then required to send a postcard to the suspected duplicate registered voters to see if they were actually still living in Indiana or if they had moved to another state and hadn't canceled their registration. General Assembly in 2017 passed a law getting rid of this postcard requirement, and with the postcard there was like a four-year delay before they could delete the voter, the suspected duplicate voter, and the new law said, no, just go ahead and delete them right away. Federal judge said that goes against a federal law that requires some safeguards in place before you start deleting voters or purging voters, as the process is known. So Indiana will, at least until an appeals court overturns that injunction, will have to continue going about cleaning up its voter rolls the same way that it has been for the past several years.
Well, it sounds like this will probably get some more stories out of this, too, even though this particular story with what Judge Pratt had taken up here is finished up for now. And we'll have you back on to talk about the next one that you have in the series, I'm sure, too. We appreciate you spending some time to talk with us today about this one, Dan, and have you back on again real soon to cover some other stories from the State House as well. Dan Cardin covers state news, state government news, and the State House when we have the legislature in session, of course, and other state news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Reporters Roundtable Thursday continues on with checking in on news on the education front. And for that, we are turning to Meredith Colias-Pete with the Post Tribune. Meredith, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, take up the latest here on the Gary Community School Corporation. I know that the one of the big issues in as the emergency management team is trying to do to help reduce the costs of running the school district and the past expenses that the school district has rung up is trying to deal with some of the employees and labor issues. Fill us in on the latest we have concerning, for example, custodians and maybe even secretaries. Those are folks that I know that are in the news lately here as far as the Gary Community Schools is concerned.
Right. Well, the emergency management team in Indianapolis earlier this month had made this announcement that they were going to outsource the remaining half of their custodians to this company called Alpha Building Maintenance Services out of Holbrook Glen. They apparently already employ half of the custodians now. They're really looking at, as you alluded to, cost savings where labor is concerned. The district is about $140 million in debt accounting now, and so they're looking for any ways that they can to save money.
One of the things I know, too, that the emergency manager, Dr. Peggy Hinckley, has been dealing with here is trying to, I guess, find a way to balance out all these extra costs in particular when they were dealing with various contracts and all. And I imagine that that was probably one of the real tasks that she and her chief financial officer, Leonard Moody, had to deal with when they first got here into Gary and started sorting through all the bills, things that needed to be paid, and the way that they had to account for them.
Yeah, and it's sort of the broad picture view of this is that the emergency manager, is thrown in there last year. Their task is sort of writing down the district's debt, tackling an $18 million, deficit that it's running per year. Unfortunately, looking at outsourcing studios and secretaries and things of that nature is kind of just a way to tackle this. I know the custodians initial estimates were that the district could save maybe $1.7 million. Possibly it's been downgraded to about $900,000 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing on this, too, is that this move is getting some pushback from labor. My colleague Carol Carlson has talked to SEIU, the union that represents custodians, and they were taken totally by surprise by this move. Same with the secretaries and custodians. I know that they have been operating under a contract that was last signed about 10 years ago in December 2007. And so since that time, they've sort of been honoring it until now.
Does it seem that maybe the SEIU and the other unions, including, for other members of the labor force with the Gary Community Schools, that maybe that they didn't think that when things changed because of the fact that the school district became a distressed unit, that the things were going to be able to go on without any change?
I guess it's hard. It's hard to know that for sure. It's hard to know that definitely. One point I do want to make that I think is important to add to this is that the school district has been accumulating debt since the emergency management team came down. They've been going down to Indianapolis past year or so, borrowing sort of a couple million dollars at a time to make payroll for their staff. And, they've been making some progress in the big picture area in terms of, making sure that their staff gets paid on time and paying down some old bills that, that Gary has been struggling to pay in recent years. Both of that definitely comes with a long-term cost.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories that you had in here recently, we wanted to take some time to talk about here, was about the legacy of Wirt Emerson School. That's a school, of course, that is based in the Miller neighborhood. It's closing, and it's going to, of course, the students that have been attending Wirt Emerson in the future are going to be going to Westside School in Gary. What's been the tally that you had and the people that you had a chance to talk to who are alumni of Wirt as their feelings about the school finally having to close after, almost 80 years now?
Sure, absolutely. the folks that we talked to going back, you know, decades, of course, it's sad for them to see that the school is closing. And it was built in Miller, 1939 or so. You know, the school's had additions added to it over the years. We really just reached out and asked folks that went to school there, you know, about their memories from high school and things like that. And, you know, over the decades, there was a lot of common themes. And one that came up over and over and over again was that they felt like, you know, like you would expect at many high schools, that it just felt like, you know, that there was a community, it was a family community, that, you know, you kept in touch with your classmates. I know that I spoke with one woman who wasn't credited in the story, but she had been responsible for organizing class reunions at work since, you know, since the 60s or so. Uh-huh. And there's been a regular group of folks from her class in that era that have been meeting up maybe like every, they kind of informally meet, I guess, every year or so, but they have reunions like every 5 years or so.
It sounds like it's going to be a very interesting place to attend class, and even up to to this year was being the last year and the last graduating class coming from it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we spoke to folks, of course, that, you know, that their spouse is there, or just remembered going to football games, or, you know, remembered people, you know, painting windows on Lake Street, which is Miller's, you know, business district, you know, years ago for homecoming and stuff like that. So it was pretty cool to hear. You know, people and what they sort of got out of high school. You know, even from the early days, people spoke of it as a, you know, close-knit community where everybody knew everybody, you know, sort of like a nucleus that sort of helped draw the community together. And, you know, as the sort of landscape in Gary changes and you see, you know, more public schools closing, you are having, you know, folks, one gentleman, you know, brought up a point in the story is that, you know, the schools were sort of the center of community, you know, where you had this kind of common bond with you know, your neighbors. And, you know, there's been more charter schools in recent years, definitely. But, you know, he particularly felt that, you know, something was being lost as the public schools disappeared from Gary. Mm-hmm.
Finally, Meredith, let's talk here about your story that you had in the Post Tribune about the W.G. Jackson research vessel. It has been making visits here to Northwest Indiana off and on for a long time, I know, and the boat had a chance to invite some folks on board to take a chance to tour and a little bit more about not only how the ecosystem is mapped here in Northwest Indiana, but on the entire Lake of Michigan, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. A colleague of mine and I got the chance to sort of hop on one of these tours earlier this week, and they took maybe about 20 people out on the lake. The boat itself, as you alluded to, the boat has been used sort of for research tours since about the mid-90s or so. Mm-hmm. One scientist on board said they come around Northwest Indiana maybe like, you know, once a year or so. And so, you know, you basically go out in the middle of the lake, and it's more tuned towards kids and, you know, adults that are, you know, into that kind of thing. But, you know, gave them some opportunities to, conduct some, I guess, basic research and kind of just, you know, kind of understand from a very basic level what goes into it. You know, how do you test your pH levels, and how do you look for water quality and, you know, plankton levels and things of that nature, just to sort of, you know, see the current state of the ecosystem. You know, I did ask them, of course, but they said that, you know, testing for things that we watch, like industrial pollutants in Lake Michigan, is, you know, a little bit, you know, above their pay grade, but it was kind of just a chance to get sort of kids in the field and you know, see how this actually works in person.
Well, it sounded like it was a very interesting tour, and it was a very interesting boat to begin with here. I'm glad that you and some other folks had a chance to take a look at it when it was here in Northwest Indiana. And we've been talking with Meredith Coleus-Pete with the Post Tribune about the stories that she's had in print and online in recent days here. And we thank you very much, Meredith, for joining us today here on Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
This is Ridgely Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and I'm Chris Nolte. And with us now is Doug Ross with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He works out at the office in Valparaiso, covering LaPorte counties and Porter County. In fact, some of the news we have to talk about is involving the city of Michigan City. And Doug, I understand that one of the big problems we've come up here is that they've discovered in Michigan City the same kinds of problems which have already happened in cities like East Chicago and sections of Hammond and Whiting. It's about lead contamination.
Right. And so what's happening in Michigan City is they've ruled out the water supply as the source of the contamination. So, you know, they've you know, got tests for elevated blood levels for a number of children in the city. They've tested, you know, only a small percentage of them, but they've got these tests that show elevated blood levels, and they pretty well narrowed it down to lead paint.
Oh.
The city has really a lot of the housing is well old. I mean, there's something like a third of it, as I recall, was built prior to 1940, and something like 75% of the houses were built prior to 1980, and it wasn't until 1978 that the U.S. banned the use of lead in paint for, you know, people's homes and apartments, you know, things like that. So, you know, what they're worried about is that the lead paint is, you know, either creating dust that's on the windowsills or on the ground, and that it's getting into young children's mouths, because, you know, kids will put anything in their mouth,
yeah,
or they'll lick anything. You know,
that's
how
right.
It goes.
Well, and you're talking about problems that have been around for at least 30 years or longer, certainly. As you say, with the older housing stock in Michigan City, it's very possible it could have gone back into the 50s easily, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, what's happened over time, and they had I know it's been quite a while back now, but last Friday they had an expert from Rochester, New York, who's doing some consulting work with the city, and he told about how he bought this old house and I forget what city it was in New York where he was living, and you know, the paint was all cracked and peeling and whatnot, so he scraped it all, you know, picked up the big chunks to throw away and all that, but you know, the fact is, the simple act of scraping the paint on the outside of his house, a lot of that dust went into the ground.
Yeah.
And so it contaminates the soil. You go into the house, every time you open and close one of those windows with the old paint, they talk about friction points, but basically, you know, what it is, you know, you're abrading the sand is like sandpaper on the windowsill, you know, you're rubbing it up and down, and that creates the dust.
That's right.
And so these children are getting that. And it may not be at their own home, and maybe at a babysitter's home or something like that, grandma's home. But, you know, the fact is these young children are dealing with that issue. So Michigan City is pretty much environmentally conscious, more than a lot of cities, I would say. And so they're really diving headfirst into this issue.
What's the city council going to be able to do now to try to start to deal with this?
Well, they started talking about it on Tuesday, and that's, you know, one of those meetings where they call it a workshop meeting, city council, school board, or whatever does a workshop meeting. So they start talking about this, but they don't really make any decisions until they're in their official meeting. So I'm not exactly sure what they're going to do, but it sounds like, you know, my take on it is I think they've got about 150 grants that they were going to put toward a federal grant that they didn't receive, as the local match to it. So I think they'll be able to use that local match to, you know, A, try to get kids tested, and then B, try to get some information out, more information than they've been doing already, and they've done a lot, frankly, to get people aware of the lead paint issue. I'm not sure yet whether they're going to adopt an ordinance that deals with inspection of rental properties, which seems to be where the majority of these are, is rentals. So I don't know if they're going to be able to pull that one off like Buffalo, New York did. That was the standard that they were looking at. But you know, certainly you're going to be hearing things about that.
Well, that's one of these stay tuned kind of situations here, too, to find out what the Michigan City officials are going to do. And I know also, too, another story that you had out there, Doug, in print as well as online in the Times recently, again from Michigan City, was dealing about the question of minority hiring in city government and some projects before city government. And it got a little testy, I understand, at a couple of the town meetings recently. Tell us about that.
So I wasn't at the Board of Works meeting. Let's see, this would have been last week ago Monday.
Yeah.
But I was at the City Council meeting a week ago Tuesday, and it all boiled up there. So Michigan City has this ordinance that says at least 50% of the wages on any public works project for the city has to be Michigan City residents. One of the pastors, Damon Carnes, is on the Michigan City Redevelopment Commission, and he's ticked off that white people in Michigan City can be hired for things like this, but you don't see a lot of minorities hired for these jobs. And so, the local hiring ordinance that Michigan City has doesn't really deal with the minority hiring because, as Mayor Ron Meir kind of was pretty testy about, he said, I'm very concerned about getting jobs for minority residents of Michigan City, and I think that the workforce should represent the demographics of the city. However, it's illegal to have an ordinance that says that you have a minority hiring quota. So he just wasn't going to, so he was trying to say, I agree with you, but we can't do it legally. And Pastor Carnes was still pretty upset about it. So it was an interesting council meeting for sure.
I would imagine. Do you get the impression from attending the meetings and hearing the conversations that Pastor Carnes is really just trying to bring up the point? And certainly this is coming at a time with the 50th anniversary of Reverend Martin Luther King's assassination and a lot of other issues which have come up here lately as well, and trying to bring equality to light in places where maybe it's need to be in light?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Pastor Carnes did fight the 50th anniversary of King's assassination by saying he took the time this year, as part of the 50th of Servants, to read the entire letter from Birmingham rather than just the highlights like mm-hmm. everybody else does.
Right.
And so we could do that. And noted that what King was saying is, you got to keep pushing, and frankly, make yourself a royal pain if you're going to accomplish anything. Just, trying to work within the system doesn't always work, was, I guess, the point of the letter.
Right.
And certainly how Pastor Carnes translated it. So, he was being aggressive. Now, the question is, what do you do? So there's, in Gary, there's this training area that's dedicated toward, and as I recall, this was something that Earlene Rogers pushed for when she cast the deciding vote that did the toll road privatization,
uh-huh.
if you remember that,
yeah.
Way back. And so that was her stipulation, that she got this built into the law so that they would create this, minority training thing to try to get more minorities into the construction trade union. And so, that's part of that. And we'll see how that plays out. But certainly that's a factor in trying to, frankly, just get more minorities into the union so that they can get these jobs.
We're talking with Doug Ross with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers news in Porter and LaPorte counties in the paper and online. And one of the other stories I know, Doug, that you had recently, a story in one of the weekend papers, dealt with the problems that the Porter County government is having in trying to get a revised 911 emergency communication system going in the community. And the idea being that there's some changes ahead, but some people don't like the way the changes are happening, and it may have brought up some interesting controversies. Tell us about your story.
Boy, it's a complex one. So basically the gist of it is Porter County has to convert to a digital radio system for dispatching, like, LaPorte County has already done that, and, Lake and so forth. And so, mm-hmm. It's something that they all have to do. So as part of this, there are a lot of moving parts. One of them is that they're moving the 911 dispatch center, Porter County Central Command, or Central Communications, I guess,
yeah.
is the name of it. They're moving that into the old jail,
right,
in downtown Valpo. So the county bought back the old jail that it had given away to the city. The city sold it. The county wants office space again, so they bought the old jail. So they're putting the radio equipment in there, and they figure as long as we're doing it, there, let's put the new stuff in. And this is going to be really high-tech, impressive stuff. So you'll be able to see, you know, like the dispatcher will be able to see live video streaming of you know, where the 911 caller is and things like this. You know, pretty amazing things. And assuming there's a camera, right? But they'll be able to do all of these cool things. And in the process, they are telling Chesterton and Porter, who have their own dispatch center, they're saying, hey, why don't you complete the consolidation and join with us? You won't have to buy your own equipment to upgrade to be compatible with what the county has. And it won't cost your taxpayers a cent. So what happens now with the dispatch is a call comes into the Porter County Central Communications, which is at the police station on the very southern edge of Valparaiso on 49. They get all of the 911 calls in the county. And then if it's a police call to Chesterton or Porter, then they transfer that call back to this Doolin Communications dispatch. I forget what it's called. But basically, they've got their own dispatchers. They've got two per shift working, and then they'll dispatch that. So you have a built-in lag time right away of, you know, taking the call, answering it, finding out, okay, here's what you need. Let me send it back to Chesterton and Porter. So, you know, the county officials are saying that is a serious issue, that lag time. And frankly, if you have a whole, you know, everything blows up in, well, not literally, but figuratively, in Chesterton or Porter, then you're going to have two really hairy dispatchers. Whereas if it went to the county one, then you've got all these cross-trained dispatchers that would be able to help.
Right.
So there's that. There's that issue. And then the other one that's really hot right now is how many is Porter County is changing the way that they're going to handle calls to, you know, for service. So if there's a call for fire or EMS, they'll have one channel that'll serve the whole county, and then they'll send the fire or EMS call to that channel. If there's one for police, minus Chesterton and Porter right now, but if there's one for police and it's an emergency, then they would send it out to one channel. Portage and some of the others want to have two channels. But here's how the county is trying to figure out. They're practicing this already, frankly, and have been for a few weeks now. They've been sending these silent dispatches. That the way it works basically is each police officer has his own laptop in the car, right? And so if it's a non-emergency thing, you know, some traffic situation or something, they can send a message in text, and then it'll, you know, ding on the officer's laptop, and then when it's safe, you can check the, you know, don't crash into a car while you're
right.
Reading your text. But you know, when it's safe, read the message, and then you can respond that way. And so that is trying to drain all of the voice traffic that's non-emergency off of that emergency channel. So all of these things are going on. You know, the county is spending millions and millions of dollars to try to do this. And then naturally all these controversies are going to pop up.
Well, it sounds like it's just going to continue on until they get the new systems going and more people familiar with it. And in this case, the police departments in Portage and in Chesterton. So they'll come online, I guess, eventually, and the things will develop, and hopefully some of these bugs will get worked out. But in the meantime, it sounds like it's going to be an interesting story, to say the least, as they work out all the bugs of this problem then, I guess.
Yeah, stay tuned for sure.
That is right. That is right. Doug Ross is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana and an editor in the Porter County and LaPorte areas. And he's been covering the stories that we've been talking about here on Regionally Speaking today. As always, Doug, thank you for joining us, and we hope to have you back on again real soon.
Oh, it's a true honor. Thank you.
Andrian has a date with Silver Creek in the Class 3A Prep Baseball state title game coming up. And after season, 59er pitcher Mike Doolin has had. Is there any doubt as to who's going to start the biggest game of the season? Well, Lakeshore Public Radio's Tommy Williams had a chance to talk with the starting pitcher before Saturday's big game.
Last week, Lake Central played in the state championship girls' softball game led by a pitcher who has to be one of the best student athletes in the state, in Alexa Parnarski. This weekend, Andrian takes on Silver Creek for the Class 3A baseball championship in Indianapolis, and the 59er starting pitcher will be a young man who has a 4.4 grade point average and will go to college at Vanderbilt. Mike Doolin has been impressive on the mound and in the classroom all season long, and his next assignment will be to lead Andrian to yet another state championship. And as you'll hear, he is looking forward to the challenge.
Oh my goodness, it's a dream come true. I never really imagined what it would be like, but now that it's here, it's crazy. Just, you know, the emotions are racing. It's a good time.
And of course, you keep up a tradition because Coach has been to a few state championships and won a few, so
yes.
How cool is that?
You know what, it's nice to be a part of the history of Andrian. The history of Andrian baseball is such a long history, and it's just a great tradition he's built here, and it's just great to be a part of like the long family that's been built.
So let's talk about your season and how it feels to be the ace of this staff.
I mean, it feels good being the one on the mound in the big games and being the person everyone kind of looks to make the big plays. I like being under pressure, and I like being the one everyone looks to. It's been a good year on the mound, and I'm just looking to continue it into the state championship this Saturday.
Let me take a wild guess and say that you're going to be the starter on Saturday.
Yes. I am. That's been pretty well known since the beginning of the season that if we made it this far, I'd be the starter, and I'm just getting ready emotionally, mentally, physically getting ready for this game.
Tell me the one thing you've learned from Coach that has really helped you.
I think body language is the biggest thing. Just when growing up, things have usually gone my way, just on the mound at least, and preparing to what it's going to be like when it doesn't go my way and how I should react, especially being the leader of this team. Just body language needs to be good, and everyone looks at you, so you got to be ready for everyone to look at you during the good and the bad.
The way you're talking, you enjoy that leadership role, do you?
Yes, I love it. I love being the one everyone looks to make the big play, the big pitch. When we need a couple words to be said, it's either me or Clay, and I love that role. I love being that person for this team, and it's good to have.
Has there been any adversity that you guys had to overcome before you got to this point?
Yes, we've played a couple rough games. We've had a couple long streaks of hitting where we haven't been hitting where we needed to be and how we've been wanting to hit. And I think on the mound we've had some struggles, the entire staff as a whole, but we battled through it, and I mean, here we are competing for a state championship.
And of course, the team that takes care of the adversity the most is the one that's going to be where you guys are.
Exactly.
Right now,
it's a game of adversity. You got to battle through it, and the team that succeeds the most is the one that takes the adversity, learns from it, and gets better.
What's the preparation coming up for Saturday?
You know, it's just getting better in all aspects of the game, hitting, pitching, mentally, just kind of control our emotions and try to do the best we can and go out there and just compete. I mean, he asks for us every day, just compete and get better, and that's what we're going to try to do on Saturday.
Was there any pitcher that you basically look up to in Major League Baseball and say, that's what I want to be?
Justin Verlander, just the way he attacks everyone with his fastball, gets ahead early with his fastball, and just his breaking pitches, second to none. Just love the way he pitches, love the way he commands his zone, and that's who I really love watching, and that's who I want to be like.
Before we let you go, hypothetical situation. You pitch a shutout on Saturday, or better yet, you guys win the state championship. What's the first thing you want to do after that's taken place?
Oh, my goodness. Probably the first thing I want to do is hug my catcher. He's been there all year for me. He's caught everything. He's been great stepping up as a sophomore and just being the catcher we needed him to be. And then right after that, I think I'm going to run to center field and give Clay Thompson a hug because he's been a big brother to me, my best friend since I've been here. And just sharing that moment with him will be just a dream come true.
You know a Golden State Warrior then, right?
Yeah.
That just bad joke. I'm sorry. Bad joke. And by the way, let's name your catcher. Who is he?
Jake Mullen.
There you go. I want to get his name out there. Congratulations on getting this far, and wish you the best on Saturday.
Thank you.
That was Andrian pitcher Mike Doolin joining us on Lakeshore Sports 219. Later in the week, you'll hear from Andrian coach Dave Pischer and Northwest Indiana Times sports writer Jim Peters as we celebrate Andrian going to the state championships in high school baseball. So make sure to stop by again, okay? That's Lakeshore Sports 219 for today. I'm Tommy Williams. God bless you. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Tommy. Lakeshore Sports 219, by the way, is the podcast, and you can catch it on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Residents of 13 more counties in Indiana, including several here in the region, have more time until July 5th, as a matter of fact, to apply for the disaster assistance that is offered up because of the flooding that happened between February 14th and March 4th of this year. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked with FEMA spokesman William Lindsay about the process.
So can you tell me why the add-on for the counties, the additional counties that are now available for the federal assistance?
Well, FEMA's been in the area ever since the flooding that occurred on February 14th through March 4th. That's considered the critical incident period. So if anyone has sustained any damages or losses during that time, we want them to register with FEMA as soon as possible. Now, we have added an additional 13 counties because we are taking advisements and doing all types of disaster assessments with our local and county stakeholders as emergency managers. And they've determined that there is a need in the additional 13 counties.
So how do people register for this assistance if they need it?
Well, the fastest way to register with FEMA is to go to our website, which is www.disasterassistance.gov. And at that site, we also have a lot of information as far as mitigation. We have a lot of information on our programs. Now, the other thing that we do is that we have our disaster survival assistance personnel, and they go door to door, making sure that anyone in the affected area is contacted and know what their recovery resources are and what's available. Now, that website, again, is disasterassistance.gov, or you can call our 1-800 number at 1-800-621-3362.
Under what circumstances are people eligible for this assistance?
Well, during that incident period, Valentine's Day, February 14th through March 4th, if they sustain any losses to their residents, any personal losses if they're renters, businesses can also get assistance through our partner, the Small Business Administration. So we bring in a whole bunch of other federal and local government resources to be able to render this type of assistance to those who need it. But it has to have occurred during that period. Now, we know it's been a long time since then. However, we're still out there, still determining that there are still people out there, survivors rather, who need this valuable recovery resources.
Now, once you apply, how long does it take to get your recovery resources?
Well, that's, you know, you've probably heard this before, you know, case-by-case jargon coming from the government, but that's really what we do. It's a case-by-case situation because every person, every household that has sustained any kind of damages, that's a very specific issue to that particular case. So our first thing is to have you register with us, and then we will send out inspectors. We will be able to look over what the damages are, because most people have already taken photos of that situation. So if you have those photos, you have those receipts for items that you may have incurred during that time, we want you to share those with us as well.
Does it guarantee that you're eligible, that you're going to get the assistance just by applying?
No, this is federal dollars. These are taxpayer dollars that we use to render these resources. So we are cognizant of what this money is going toward and for. So if you have legitimate needs or you have legitimate losses, you are the person we want to hear from.
Okay. Is there any kind of top out, the most that you'll pay out?
Well, our thing is we don't duplicate insurance programs, so we won't be duplicating your insurance adjusters, or a lot of people are underinsured, and that's what this money is for. And as far as a top rate there, we don't want to go into specifics with that because that varies.
Can you tell me which Northwest Indiana counties are eligible? Can you name them?
Right now, we have Lake County, St. Joseph. We have Carroll, White. Those are the areas that I am covering right now, and I'm waiting for additional counties to come on board. So I was just in Plymouth this morning down there because we have a disaster recovery center in place. And what you also see throughout the affected areas is that our mitigation teams will be set up at area Lowe's and Home Depot's, and they will be supplying those who have had losses on how to rebuild, how to mitigate for a possible next situation. So we're always trying to make our living spaces stronger to be able to adapt to any type of disasters. And that's what you'll find on our website, disasterassistance.gov, a whole lot of information on what to do.
So mitigate meaning like how to build so it doesn't happen again?
Exactly. What precautions to take. Also, you get advice on how to hire contractors And one thing we have to say is that, you know, disaster fraud is something that is a reality in our country. Well, I travel all over the nation doing emergency management, and we do have a lot of predators out there. So anyone that you may encounter who says that they are a FEMA representative or a local county emergency management representative, if they ask for any type of financial compensation, that's your first red flag that they are not legitimate. And we ask that you call your local law enforcement agency immediately.
Is there anything else that you want to tell me that maybe I haven't asked you about?
Well, one thing is that we know that Indianans are very resourceful. And we also know that as far as the registration, a lot of people are waiting. The registration deadline is July 5th. So you have a little bit of time, but don't wait. Let's get this process going, because that's what it is. It's a process. And there's a lot of curves to this process. And that's our way of being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. So if you had disasters, or maybe you have experience in a previous disaster here in Indiana, we ask that you help your neighbor, help them wade through the waters, if you will, of the FEMA process. They're not that difficult. A lot of people think that if they are told that, well, at this time, we need to see you to talk about your application. It's not a denial. It's just that we need to talk about certain things that you may have left out of your application. And a lot of times that can be that you didn't sign the portion that renders aid from the Small Business Administration. That is very crucial. A lot of people don't want a loan at this particular point, but we want them to know their full extent of their recovery resources. So once that form is not signed, we have to stop and then contact you to let you know that we want you to sign that form. You don't have to take a loan, but we want you to know your full extent of your recovery resources.
I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about, loan. I thought this was, it's not a loan, is it?
Well, see, that's the issue. FEMA has, well, basically grants. These are recovery resources, and that's taxpayer dollars. But the Small Business Administration, they come into play because a lot of people are underinsured, and they may want additional monies to be able to mitigate their residence. We don't provide monies for replacement of cars and buildings that are away from their domicile. So the home that you sleep in, that's our primary concern. And also we hope that you have flood insurance. A lot of folks don't have flood insurance. And that's where SBA, Small Business Administration, can come in with assistance as well.
So when would a loan come into play?
Well, just like that. If you're underinsured and you need help with rebuilding, they have very low interest loans for you. However, with FEMA, our mandate is to make sure that we return you to a safe and clean, nurturing home environment. So if you have your clothing is lost, we have a whole lot of programs there with Salvation Army, with the Red Cross, with the Catholic Charities. A lot of volunteer organizations come to play in our time of need to support FEMA's mission. So FEMA gives what's grants. So any money that you get from FEMA, you don't have to pay back. But our partner, the Small Business Administration, they provide monies for any type of improvements above what FEMA is able to give out.
Oh, I understand. Okay, thank you for explaining that.
Well, and one thing is that you may hear about individual assistance. Well, individual assistance is for the homeowner, resident, the renter. Public assistance is for the infrastructure. That's the road buildings, bridges, libraries, water concerns, electrical concerns, anything to deal with the government side of the infrastructure.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.
That's FEMA spokesman William Lindsay speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson. That's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to Doug Ross and Dan Carden with The Times, and with Meredith Coleus-Pete with The Post Tribune, and to Lakeshore Public Radio's Tommy Williams and Sharon Jackson for their contributions. And we'll be back with you with a special edition of Regionally Speaking on Monday.